Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today we have a very special episode. It's our 50th episode, and we're going to be talking about an entirely new area of emergency dispatch medical practice, instructing tourniquet application. New science has changed the practice of tourniquet use in tactical settings, and the unfortunate reality of increased mass casualty incidents makes this practice more applicable to the dispatch environment than ever. Our guests today were lead authors on the study that designed and tested the soon-to-be-released Tourniquet Pre-Arrival Instruction Protocol, Protocol T, and we'll be talking about that study and the new instructions. Welcome, Greg Scott and Dr. Paul Stiegler.
Thank you.
Oh, good to be here.
So before we get started with that, could you each give our listeners a little bit of background? In particular, how did you get into public safety and how did you end up in your current role? So, Dr. Stiegler, let's start with you.
Well, you want me to go back 50 years? That'd be fine. Well, I'm an emergency physician by trade, been doing it for many years and got involved in EMS and emergency medical dispatch a long time ago through my work in Dane County in Wisconsin. I was the medical director of a 911 center, the county medical director for EMS, so I've been involved in this a long time, involved with the academy for a long time, and so it was just natural to be part of this. I'm on the readers group and to advance the protocol, so honored to be doing that. And just over the years, it became apparent that the tourniquet issue was very important, especially lately, and was involved with Greg in trying to get this started. And how would we go about getting a protocol and get it out there? And here we are.
All right. And Greg, what's your background?
Yeah, well, I kind of stumbled into dispatch after a few other experiences in public safety, primarily in fire EMS. I started off as a volunteer firefighter in a little town in Southern California, close to where I was living at the time. And I got into that, I think, just through some peer pressure. A couple of college buddies of mine convinced me that they were doing some seasonal firefighting and volunteer firefighting and convinced me that it would look good on my resume. And it sounded exciting and adventurous. So I did that for a little while. And I soon realized that really the fire service handles a lot more EMS calls than they do fire calls. So that led me to really seek out some more formal EMS training. And I got certified as an EMT, which led to an actual paid full-time position with a local ambulance service, and continued getting some more training, advanced level training in EMS and training with the fire service. And I was all ready to pursue a career, I think, as like a firefighter paramedic, until one day I got recruited into the dispatch center in our ambulance agency. And that at the time didn't really feel like a career change for me, because I could still do a lot of shifts out in the field as a responder, train with the fire service. But about 3 months into it, I realized that it could be a career, because several things really appealed to me. One was the fast-paced environment of dispatch. You know, with your field training, you're trained to handle one call at a time. You go on a call, and for the next 45 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, you're handling that one call. Whereas in dispatch, things come at you really fast, and you got to do a lot of on your feet multitasking and problem solving and so forth. And that kind of appealed to me. The other thing that I really liked about dispatch was the new technology that was coming on at the time. And this is going back some decades. I think that's a process that's still taking place today. But the new technology that was being brought on, I saw that as a real potential where the dispatch center could become the driver for change in and really fire EMS and all of public safety. And what's interesting is I think that's an evolution that's still taking place today as we speak. And I think there's a lot of exciting things coming down the pike for dispatch. So years later, here I am working with the Academy and the research department.
Okay. So Dr. Stiegler, can you start us off by giving us some background on the new tourniquet science? You mentioned this a little bit earlier. What has the previous understanding been about tourniquet use and what's changed?
Well, way before we actually had some wars that prove this, the thought was that by keeping a tourniquet on, it was dangerous to the limb and long-term side effects, and there was no outcome studies as far as saving lives. But obviously with the Vietnam War, the Afghanistan War, the Iraq War, the data coming out of that, it's been definitely proven that tourniquets do save lives, and the risk-benefit ratio of, you know, having a bad limb versus saving a life is skewed totally to saving a life now, and it works in the science in there. And so we're just following in what is now accepted practice in the EMS world on the dispatch side, and realize that, you know, we're the first ones really to be talking to people who are coming on these injuries who are lay people, and realize that we should be doing something to help them with massive bleeding. And so that's how we got into it.
Do you want to add anything to that?
From the EMS perspective, I can remember when I first trained as an EMS responder, we weren't even allowed to apply tourniquets. They were taboo out in the field. Because, you know, as Dr. Stiegler kind of alluded to, they were considered too dangerous. There was some concern that applying tourniquets in the pre-hospital environment would cut off the circulation long enough to where you would lose the limb, or you had more chance to lose the limb with a tourniquet on than just doing other means of bleeding control. And that's actually, the science has evolved over the years, and I think the military had a lot to do with that in terms of their battlefield studies showing that tourniquets actually are safe to use in a pre-hospital environment.
And I understand that one of those changes has been that there was this idea that if you kept a tourniquet on for any period of time, that the limb would just die and you were never going to get circulation back. And they've sort of changed that idea, haven't they?
Yeah, the studies suggest now that even if you cut off circulation completely, which is actually what you do when you apply a tourniquet to a severely bleeding limb, you cut off circulation to the distal part of that limb. But the studies have actually shown that you can go at least 2 hours without any, you know, permanent tissue or neurological damage to the limb. And with, you know, the surgeries that they're doing nowadays, can be even longer than that. You know, and in most, at least urban and semi-urban EMS settings, you're going to be at the emergency room or in the OR, in the operating room, a lot sooner than that, you know, that 2 hour window.
So, Greg, you led the initiative here to turn this new science into a pre-arrival instruction protocol. So can you tell us a little bit, what does Protocol T look like? What does it do and what does it have on it?
Well, we went at this really sort of organically. We thought, you know, if we were going to have an instruction for laypersons to apply a tourniquet over the phone, we thought we probably ought to get some laypersons involved in testing it. And that was the crux of our study. Dr. Stiegler and I and a few others sat down and actually designed what we thought would work with some, you know, we used the standard panel logic, which has been, you know, sort of a staple of our pre-arrival instructions for many years now in the MPDS. And we sat down with that sort of panel logic format and put down some instructions on paper that we thought would work, and went through a few pre-study trials with some people around the office and so forth, and refined it a little bit. And then we just took it out into the real world and tested it out there.
And so what are the specifics of the protocol? What all is on there? What kinds of instructions are available?
So we went at it with the idea that there are going to be times when a commercially manufactured tourniquet would be available. Some of you may have heard of the Stop the Bleed campaign, which is a national campaign to get tourniquets out into public places, airports, universities, high schools, and other places where they would typically hang next to or inside of an AED box. So similar to the AEDs that are out there now, you're seeing bleeding control kits and tourniquets show up in the same place. So the idea was there would be some cases where you might have mass casualty events, shootings, explosions, and that sort of thing taking place in public places where you would have a commercial tourniquet available. But there'd also be other situations where no commercial tourniquet would be available. So we wanted to have a protocol that would cover both scenarios. That was kind of where we started from. And then we decided, well, there probably are a couple of different commercial tourniquets that might be available, and they might have different ways to apply them. So we looked at that and tried to structure our instructions around the notion that, okay, we'll start with the most common commercial tourniquets out there, and then we'll look at, can we genericize these instructions to the lesser known commercial tourniquets, as well as having a makeshift, something that you can improvise on scene with just a piece of cloth and a stick, really. So those were the scenarios that we were most interested in.
Yeah, we're going to come back and talk about the makeshift tourniquets in a second. Dr. Stiegler, could you weigh in here just for a second? I know you came here to Salt Lake City to participate in at least part of this study. Can you talk us through what did you see during the study? What was actually done, and how was the protocol actually tested?
Well, our big objective and challenge was to try to come up with script and instructions that were simple enough in an EMD environment to tell someone at the scene what to do with either a commercial tourniquet or a makeshift tourniquet, and make it as simple as possible. And that was the initial challenge. How do you come up with a protocol de novo? And we'd all spend time looking at these things and coming up with verbiage. And we had our best guess after numerous additions between us all, and came up with what we thought would be the good script. And then we actually tested it by using an artificial bleeding limb called the HapMed limb. The half a limb, it's got some ugly looking things at the end that glow and a red light, and it's got a pressure monitor inside of it. And if you put the tourniquet over the right spot on the thigh, and as you turn it down, the red light on the distal limb slowly goes out, which means that the bleeding has stopped. And there's a digital readout on a screen on the leg that says how much blood has been lost and how fast. And that's what we use as our bleeding limb. And using lay people calling into a 911 operator or an EMD who was in another room, who trialed using the script for them to tell them how to do what they needed to do for the bleeding limb. And that was the work of the trials to see what worked, what didn't work, what were the better ways to say things, what made more sense. And we were able to massage it to where we were really comfortable that what was said on the script was being translated to the caller on how to do it. And we learned a lot of things, and I think we've come up with something that's fairly reproducible and can actually affect a change in the EMD environment.
So you said one thing there that I think is important, which is you said that you developed this protocol de novo, which basically means from scratch, from nothing. So this is really the first protocol, a particular PAI protocol, developed and then tested and studied as a whole in depth before being released for public use. Is that right?
To my knowledge, yes. I mean, as far as de novo, we did use some of the language or some of the commercial language that was with the commercial tourniquets. They have their own instructions and fancy pictures, you know, for someone to look at and do. But we had to translate some of those words and phrases into totally auditory type instructions. And so we had to change a lot of them and make up some of our own how to say things and how to, you know, affect a true use of the tourniquet. And so you're right. I think this is the first time that any instructions have been come up with to tell someone over the phone.
And Greg, can you talk just a little bit about what was found during the study? I mean, one of the things I think that the study was most interested in was, can lay people even apply a tourniquet when instructed over the phone? I don't think we really knew that. So what did you find in the study?
Yeah, that was really the crux of what we were trying to discover was, you know, once we developed a set of instructions, which we thought were reasonably good for laypersons, could they really follow it over the telephone? And if they could follow it, would it happen fast enough? Because we know that in a lot of these scenarios of severe bleeding, severe limb injury, a couple minutes could make a big difference in terms of bleeding control. So what we found was actually quite surprising. We were quite pleased at our results. I guess I should say, first of all, we took the instructions to several different venues that we thought were, you know, a true cross-section of the public in different settings. So we were at a university, we were at an airport, at a church, and just some random people in an office building here in Salt Lake. And so we had all of these different venues, and we were testing, as Dr. Stiegler mentioned, and testing it in a simulation environment, but, you know, in a way that we thought was reasonably close to being live. But anyway, our results, we actually were quite surprised because just over 80% of all the participants, and we're talking about a total of 246 trials, so 246 independent individuals, just over 80% were able to completely stop the bleeding within the time frame that we had. We were using a mid-range bleeding scenario where 2,500 milliliters of blood loss. Once you get beyond that, considered the patient doesn't survive in the pre-hospital environment. So within 5 minutes, 2,500 milliliters of blood loss was considered not survivable. And what we actually found was that just over 80% of the participants were able to stop the bleeding within that time frame, meaning that the patient was considered stable and survived the event. About another 6.5% had the tourniquet applied, but the bleeding was still occurring. In other words, they didn't get it on quite tight enough. But in many of those cases, of course, the bleeding was slowed significantly, and you would expect that, you know, a fast response by trained professionals would have potentially saved the victim there. So it was only about 13% of the time that the patient was considered lost or didn't survive in the full study trial group. So we were quite surprised about that. We had, as far as the demographics, like I said, I think we got a pretty good cross-section of ages and backgrounds, levels of education and abilities. And the gender was, we found that survival status did not depend on gender or age, which again we thought was a really positive thing for us, because that's all of those things are indicators that the protocol instructions could work and should work in a real setting.
Well, and with 80% plus up to 86 or 87, if you add those additional 6.5%, I mean, all of those are potentially people who, in the case of a 4 or 5 minute response or longer, would most likely have bled to death.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, even in the best of circumstances in an urban setting where you have fast response times from your responders, you're still talking about from the time the call is placed to 911 to the time the responders actually get next to the patient. So it's not just driving time. It's also getting to the patient's side and actually beginning some sort of treatment. You're still talking easily 5 or 6 minutes. So we really felt that our study results showed that the dispatcher could make an impact in that 5 or 6 minutes, and a substantial impact with the numbers we came up with.
So
the
what,
other thing
oh,
as well
ahead.
Is that, yeah. If I might, you know, we designed the study to have a certain amount of bleeding rate for all the different cases. Where in reality, in the real world, in an event, it's going to be a scatter. There'll be some that is really severe. There'll be some that are not bleeding as much, and so even a tourniquet. So let's say it's 25% as fast as our study. A tourniquet would be good for longer, and so in the real world, it's going to help a lot of other people, even though you have this 5-minute window that we artificially put on our cases.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I wanted to bring up something that was mentioned earlier, which is the issue that a lot of people bring up is that it's good to have these instructions, but most people don't have access to a tourniquet. So it's important that there are makeshift tourniquet instructions in here. And Paul, I wonder if you can tell us, what are some of the items that people can use just around wherever they are that they might have access to, that they can use to make a tourniquet? And if they have those, how do you go about creating a tourniquet out of just pieces of cloth or sticks that you have around?
That's a really good question for me, because my philosophy is that as an EMD, we're going to get the calls from the non-professionals, and the probability of a commercial tourniquet being available is low. And so we really had to make sure that we had the availability to come up with something else, a makeshift. And so we looked at a lot of things, and what we found out is that the most important thing, and the word tourniquet comes from the French to turn. And so we realized that a true tourniquet has to have a piece of material that you can actually turn and twist and increase the pressure on the limb. And so with that knowledge, we found out that actual belts don't work. Leather belts, you cannot twist them. They're too hard, you just can't get any torque on it. So things like cloth or bathrobe belts or just plain cloth are the best. A tie works. You know, I tested my tie and it was wonderful. It doesn't tear and it's about the right width, about 2 inches. And so as long as you can tie something down on the limb, get a stick, or they call a windlass, and put it on top of the half knot, tie another half knot over it, and then start twisting, that was the best way to do a makeshift tourniquet. Those were the ones we used. Then we tried to find out, the other thing is, well, how do you find a stick, or what's available that everybody has? And not everybody's, you know, going to be finding a stick or a rod or a round. And so we came up with, what else can we use? And so I actually tested pens. Typically, people will have a pen, but I found that one pen doesn't work, two pens don't work, but three pens is the transition where you can use three pens and turn that. And I also found out most people have cell phones now, and cell phones are big, and if you put them down flat, they will turn enough. And so that was kind of interesting. We have those as suggestions in the protocol, and hopefully, but something will be able to be worked out that, you know, we found that shirts, if you've got a long enough shirt or a sleeve of a shirt, is the right kind of fabric.
So what it sounds like is you really need a piece of cloth and then something to lay across it to almost act as a handle that you can get a grip on and really turn and turn and turn until the cloth is tightened down enough to really stop the bleeding.
Exactly. The true meaning of tourniquet.
So, Greg, can you just add a little bit to that, which is, I think a lot of people will want to know, when should you use a tourniquet? Because if I understand correctly, we're going to continue to have our regular bleeding control instructions for most bleeding situations. So there are specific kinds of situations in which a tourniquet is more appropriate?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, in consulting the research and all the experts on this, the direct pressure is still going to be the front line instruction and the front line treatment for any kind of, or most types of bleeding. Most bleeding, external bleeding, can be controlled with direct pressure. The tourniquet is really for the catastrophic limb injuries. I guess there's a range, there's a spectrum of what they could include, but primarily it's things like you would get either in a mass shooting where, you know, these real high power rifles just basically destroy the the arteries and the vasculature of your limb, or a or an explosion, sort of a Boston marathon kind of explosion, where you have all this shrapnel being sprayed all over the place and doing the same thing to your limb. So it's the catastrophic limb injuries that we're targeting. And so the protocol is structured so that it's going to kind of look for those things. It'll lead you to the protocol T, tourniquet instructions, if it's a clear and obvious event where you have that kind of an injury. Otherwise, it'll still take you to the direct pressure bleeding control instructions. So yeah, that's an important distinction. We're still going to push direct pressure as being the, you know, sort of the front line for most types of external bleeding. It's just these very specific, almost like, if you think about it in the military sense, sort of battlefield type injuries to the limb where the tourniquet is most effective.
And finally, Greg, what are the next steps for the tourniquet protocol and for this study?
Well, for the study, we are still analyzing the data, and we're going to write it up into a formal paper. And if you know anything about research, researchers like to get their stuff published. So eventually we will submit the study for publication somewhere. We're not sure where yet. But I think more importantly for the dispatch community, if you're a practicing EMD or practicing dispatcher out there, I think you want to look for the training lesson. We're going to have a college lesson that'll be simultaneous to the protocol release of the tourniquet instructions. And recognize too that this is a protocol we don't expect to be used frequently. It'll be rare instances. It's kind of like the active assailant, active shooter protocol, where it doesn't get used often, but when it does get used, it's critical. It could actually save lives in those rare instances where it does get used. So, you know, if you're a practicing EMD or dispatcher out there, I would suggest that you really focus on understanding how to use it in those, what we call the low frequency, high risk situations. And probably the best way to do that is just get yourself trained, look for the college lesson, and do as much refresher on that as you can.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here and discussing this new direction in emergency medical dispatch practice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, and look forward to this going forward.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.